on 1116 SEN, The Right Time with Gavin Crosisca, Nick Hall and Mark Fine.
And it's time to welcome Nick Hall and Jack Nagle, both from Dahab, 1-800-329-422. There's inpatient services, and also you can, if it's impossible to, in your current situation, see yourself heading into rehab and checking in for a couple of weeks, saying goodbye to the world, there's an outpatient type service, which means you can almost 9-to-5 it. As I welcome Mick Hall, and that's all in Glen Waverley.
Correct, Amundo. You've got it right this time, Finey. Unbelievable. You're getting good.
Do you have, like, mental 50-50s that will plague you for time eternal? Like, for me, it's always trying to remember which Scott coaches which team.
Yeah, I do get it from time to time, Finey. I get it with names, you know, people's names.
Yeah, whether he's a Jeff or a John or
And it's it messes with my mind.
Yeah, I think it's.
I get it wrong every time too.
That's the thing. You always get it wrong, and you think, right, don't go for the obvious one. And when it comes to the next time, you think, which one was the obvious one? I have it with cutlery at home, where I can never tell which is the fork, the knife, the soup spoon or the dessert spoon, unless I pull the drawer out all the way to the end.
I tell you what, that is, I haven't got it quite that bad, but I have, you know, I have, that has struck me from time to time, you know. It's a pretty intricate thing, the old cutlery drawer.
I just take one of each, and I know you don't really need a fork for soup, but I often start with a fork for soup. Well, welcome back, Jack Nagle. He's part of Dahab, and like Mick Hall there, because life's experiences took him to the depth of, I won't even say despair. Tonight we might even touch on depravity through his addiction. He lifted himself up with help of others back into a world that he wanted to be in, and now offers that insight as part of his professional life helping others. How are you, Jack?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me here again. Always enjoy it.
So I just said something there, gentlemen, that is central to the metamorphosis from addict into recovery, and that is that Jack returned to a place that he wanted to be in.
Yes.
In the end, as much as loved ones will see potentially somebody that they care for dearly taking their own lives, in no, not couching the terms, the addict has to want to be somewhere else for it to be a success, doesn't it?
Yes, you're right, Finey. The addict does need to want to be somewhere else, but it's, I guess, a step further than that, and I'm sure you can kind of concur with this, Jack, that it's not just about wanting to be somewhere else. It's more not wanting to be where you are. 100%. If that makes sense, like it's not like, you know, like the addict doesn't go, right, this is enough. I'm going to pull up my socks. I'm going to make a healthy life choice, and I'm going to, you know, do this, and this, and improve my life. I mean, for a person that's in full blown addiction, I mean, that's just fantasy land. That is not part of the equation. But what is really, you know, I guess part of the, you know, decision making process and the beginning of that process of change is that the person normally will go through a point where they're in such excruciating emotional, psychological, sometimes financial, not always, you know, physical, whatever it is, but in some sort of you know, extreme kind of discomfort and pain.
Is that why you always point out that, and this is something that I only learned and probably would have, it's almost counterintuitive to how I thought was the best way to attack addressing somebody's addiction with them,
yeah,
is you often point out, Mick, that the best time for an intervention, the best time to talk to somebody earnestly about their addiction,
yep,
is when they're at a low ebb.
Oh, it's, we call it the perfect storm, Finey. You know, and Jack knows this. He does a lot of the assessments at Dahab, and so he's a guy on the front line now that handles, you know, a lot of the people that are first coming in or making first contact. with us, and tell us a bit about it, Jack. Like, what's...
Well, it's funny that we brought up the topic because I had about three scenarios just like it today.
And, three in one day.
And the ones that always come through and work is when family really plays ball with us. And don't get me wrong, I understand it's incredibly difficult to put extreme barriers in place and basically just tell your loved one that I've had enough and I can't support you in any way. But in my experience of being on the front line, as Mick said, that's the only thing that works, that actually pushes someone in the right direction to get the help.
So, for want of a better term, tough love. It's
100%. But it's detaching with love, really, and still letting someone know that you're here to help, and that help means treatment. But other than that, I can't do anything for you.
The other thing, too, is that when we say sort of tough love, another really good kind of phrase or couple of words to wrap around that as well is a unified front, right? So it can't just be one person giving tough love and another person running around mopping up the mess and... Yeah. And
so what are the practical manifestations of mopping up the mess?
So you know, like, if I don't pay these bills, he's going to go bankrupt. Mm. If I don't, you know, look, if I don't give him somewhere to live, he'll have nowhere to live. He'll be on the streets. If I don't ring his work and make excuses for him or her, they'll lose their job. But guess what? You can't do that. It's really one of those weird things where you think it looks like the loving thing to do is to protect that person from consequences that could hurt them long term.
Yep.
But in doing that, what happens is that you actually make it easy for that person to continue the same behaviour because somebody else cleans it up. And just as we were talking before the show started, there comes a time where the addict has to take some bloody responsibility for the frigging mess that they've made. But unfortunately with addiction, it's no good just getting angry with the person. What needs to happen is a unified front where all the props, which are the people that are propping that person up and allowing them to continue in their addiction, that they create a unified front. And they all go, you know what? We ain't doing this anymore. There's no more money. There's no more ringing work. And if you come here pissed or, you know, affected by drugs, you ain't staying here. Pure and simple. Now, what that does is that forces that person that's suffering from addiction, okay, into a really tough spot. All right? A really tough spot. And let me get... You know, let me get kind of real about this too. It doesn't always work. There's no one size fits all, although that is a really good strategy. You know, we are dealing with addiction, and if a person could just pull up their socks and turn everything around, then you know what? We wouldn't have rehabs, or if we did, they'd be full and no one would ever use or drink again. We'd have 100% success rate and there'd be no more problem of addiction. But that's not the case. The case is that this is a really powerful illness that's beyond emotional, psychological manipulation, that's beyond love or anything like that. So what we hope for is that the person is forced into a position where they feel the full brunt of their consequences. And then, but that's not enough to just provide that, right? That's almost handing a death sentence. It's no point providing that unless there's some sort of plan or some sort of avenue as a solution. So we can force consequences onto a person but give them no solution. Well, what's the point of that? What's the point of that?
So often in observing what happens around me now with open eyes, may it be scenarios on television, reading in newspapers, hearing personal stories from people, and just listening to the calls and reading the SMSs here, I get a sense that some of the enabling is done by people who have a sense of guilt and feel in part responsible for that person's addiction.
Jack, this is a question for Jack off the back of that comment, Viney. Who, Jack, is the greatest stumbling block to an addict getting well or getting help?
The family, every time.
Exactly. Exactly. Every time. That's our biggest problem, is family.
But is there a sense sometimes where a family member, a parent, a sibling, even a child, somebody very close, feels that their previous behaviours, so it might be a case of a parent who themselves battled alcoholism or battled with drugs, or a parent who didn't provide the stable upbringing that they, in their heart of hearts, felt contributed to the addiction somewhere down the track, enabling the addict because of some sense of guilt.
Yeah, you're spot on. Look, I'd like to cite my own experience here in terms of my daughter, my 26-year-old daughter, is an addict. She's in recovery at the moment. She's nearly 120 days clean and sober, which is amazing, right? She was an absolutely hectic addict. She was very much like me. So violence, you know, all of the things that happens to a young woman that is just absolutely out there using ice and using every other drug, all happened to her and more. She's very, very lucky to be alive. And I would get people say to me all the time, yeah, but what were you doing when you were her age, right? Because I would give her no help. I'd get very tough on her, right, and go, I'm not going to help you unless you want to be helped, right? And people would throw this up at me, and I'm just lucky that I was smart enough and I'd done enough work on myself, and I said, you know what? I might have been doing worse when I was her age, but look what happened to me, right? Look what happened to me. My life was horrendous. Why would I possibly excuse, right, my daughter's life being horrendous just because I did worse when I was younger? That's just rubbish, nonsense, utter rubbish. So I stuck to my guns and
that's what it is. It requires sticking to your guns, doesn't it? Because
absolutely,
if mistakes were made in the past, then you're only compounding them by enabling behaviours now that will ultimately result in either death or imprisonment. I mean, ultimately death, but
yep.
The short term.
Sometimes it takes imprisonment.
The short term salve is to say, you know, I wasn't there for you when I was a kid. Say a parent who, a child from a broken home who turns to a father that was absent during their childhood and asks them now for money or for accommodation or for help because that's the latest tactic in maintaining the addiction.
Yep.
The short term salve to that father's conscience might be to offer the house or offer the money.
Very tempting.
Because they weren't there in the early days. But you need to be very strong and resolute in the understanding that.
And that's actually essentially selfish. Mm. It doesn't look like it is, but it is.
No, I'm saying that's it is. You're probably meeting your own needs and addressing your own shortcomings.
Yep.
Where in the short term, but that's not to say that money's not available, but money is available. If money is available, it's not always available, but if there is finances available, then those finances will be absolutely spent on you, but spent on your recovery, not spent on feeding your addiction.
Yeah,
that's right. And look, what we're talking about is an intervention process, and the most important thing to do in an intervention process is you have to have some leverage with the person. So if I look back on my experience, the thing that was the most important to me was my younger brother.
Mm.
And that was the only thing that could snap me out of my delusion was when I looked at him and I saw the pain in his face. And for someone else, it could be completely different. It could be completely different. It could be their job. It could be their sport. It could be anything. But it's about finding what's the most important thing to that person and using that leverage to get them into treatment.
Absolutely. And to give that hope of connecting back. And that's something that we constantly do. So over the years of working with people trying to help them to not only to get well, but to want to get well. You know, like a lot of people are under the misconception, Finny, that that you've got to want to get well to go to rehab. And what our experience is that's rubbish, right? Because that's our job, to produce that. There's very, very few people come into rehab going, yes, I'm here, right? Very few. Normally there's enormous pressure on them.
Kicking and screaming.
Yeah. There's normally enormous pressure on that person to get there. Right, through external circumstance, they might try and present like it's because they want it.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Because they know that's what is expected of them.
Correct. That's it's not really it. But it's our job in the treatment. And this is part of the magic that happens with when a person does get help or gets the right help.
So just on that.
Yep.
So because a lot of what an addict does is mask their behaviours, and may it be from work, family, or the authorities, their fellow users, their fellow gamblers, or whatever. I don't think it's a lifestyle that is out front and open.
Yep.
Once they are in the hands of professionals, the professional is a professional because they can establish what the person is thinking and what their end game is,
yep,
as compared to what they might say or what they might be doing. You need to know what... When the process ends and when this is all done,
yep,
you need to know whether that person wants to be clean or whether that person is putting up with it and wants to get back to where he was or she was.
Well, you're right, Finey. And so there's a couple of things there. First things first is that we can see behind what's being said because we've been there and done it. We understand.
Yeah, that's key. That is key. Look, we need to take a break. David in Caulfield has rung in. You can as well, and we encourage you to do so. 9429 1116. But the experience of having lived it and then knowing exactly what are the thoughts and what are the real motives behind an addict's behaviour are important. And we'll get a perspective from a very young recovering addict in Jack and an older, wiser, but seen it all type bull in Mick. And we'd love to get your perspective, may it be from an addict's standpoint or from those desperately trying to help. All that comes up after the break. There's no time like the right
time. Like the right time. Welcome back, 1116 SEN.
Just some sports updates, and the A-League's sort of night of nights has just been held. The Johnny Warren Medal for the Outstanding Player of the Season has been awarded to Wellington Phoenix star Nathan Burns, also a Socceroo. We'll expand on that when Braden comes in at the end of the program for what the papers say. And in the NRL tonight, the Dragons, St George Illawarra Dragons' six-game winning streak has been broken by the reigning premiers, the Rabbitohs, 16-10. And the Rabbitohs, I believe, are heading to Melbourne next week to take on Melbourne Storm in a blockbuster, top-of-the-table type clash as the Rabbitohs look to regain the sort of form that won them the premiership last year. In the studio, Mick Hall and Jack Nagle from Dayhab. We have been talking about tough love. We have been talking about being able to understand, not from the actions of the addict and not from their words and not from their promises, but from their behaviours and from little tells, exactly what is going on in their mind and whether or not compliance, even to an intervention and off to a rehab facility, is what you hope it to be and might be very different to what their thinking will play out in the days and weeks to come. Before we do readdress that thought, let's go to David in Caulfield, who has been waiting patiently, and we thank him for that. Good evening, David.
Yeah, hello, Mark, and Mick and the other gentleman you got there. Look, mate, Mick, do you believe that alcoholism is genetic?
Yeah, look, there's definitely a genetic component. It's... Yeah, there is. It is.
It is, because this is my story. I grew up with domestic violence.
Yep.
Very bad domestic violence when I was a kid, and I was subjected to it from about 8 till 11. And my mum took my brother and I out of a very violent situation. And we basically lived in a one-bedroom flat till I was about 14. I went to a private school.
Yep.
I was very smart at school. I was a very good football player. But all of a sudden, when I was about 19, I got stuck in the booze.
Yep.
And gladly, I'm out of it now.
Good.
Yeah, but it destroyed my life, Mick. It really did.
So when you were saying that you're in your family, you know, you suffered a lot of domestic violence, so I'm tipping that was from your father or your mother's partner or whoever it was.
No, it was from my father. My father's German. He's 83. He was a member of the Hitler Youth Movement. He was very violent. He was, it was disgusting, Mick. I had to call the ambulance one night because he perforated her eardrum and threw her down the stairs and broke her ankle.
Yeah.
And as a 12-year-old boy, I had to go
You had a lot of childhood trauma there. A lot of people that went through domestic violence. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons for that, you know, for the domestic violence, and usually there's alcohol involved, but not always. But what I can tell you is that when someone starts drinking, they get a problem through drinking. If there's been past trauma in their life, that can, you know, leave obviously it leaves emotional and psychological scars. And when a person starts to get stuck into the drink, they find some relief from that. That doesn't make them an alcoholic to start with. But, you know, not all addiction, okay, is, it doesn't have to be genetic, right? There can be a genetic component to addiction, but you can drink yourself and use yourself into addiction. And that just means that you drink so much and so often, and so much dopamine is produced in your brain that the neurological pathways become cemented into your brain. And these pathways, we can't get rid of them. Once an alcoholic and addict, always. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand that, Mick, but he used to tell me stories about, you know, when he was a kid in Germany and growing up and, you know, like going to, you know, just dead bodies and things like that. And I thought, oh, shit, how could you go through that as a kid? But he was just an alcoholic
So the alcoholism ran in the family, and that quite often happens, although it doesn't always. So just because dad's an alcoholic, and there might be, let's just say there's three kids in the family, it doesn't mean that all three kids are going to be any type of addict or alcoholic. It might be one might get the gene and might take that up, and the other two could be fine.
David, could I just ask, how old are you?
I'm a year older than you, fine. I'm 48.
I wish I was 47. You're not keeping up with the latest. I'll be 50 in exactly 10 days. So I've galloped ahead of you, David, which is a great effort. Not many people get lapped, but I'm aging that quickly that I have. David, do you feel at the time, at 19, when you sought some refuge from the bottle and unfortunately thereafter became an alcoholic, there would have been precious little services, precious few services, certainly no weekly radio program and exposure that we get in the newspaper and on television. Do you feel, but at the time, was it very much a lonely, solitary experience without much of a place to go?
And that was my next point, because I was in the Royal Australian Navy. I had very good jobs. I had very, very good jobs. I was I got out as a chief petty officer in the Royal Australian Navy, but I've always battled the bottle, so to speak.
Was that battle very much on your own back when you were a young man?
Yeah. I had no... See, the thing that I wanted to ask Mick is this. We talk about family, talk about friends, but there's people out there that don't have anyone to talk to.
Correct.
And that's where the problem lies. I mean, they come home to their solace of their house or whatever, and they just get stuck into it. And that's where the problem lies, because a lot of families and a lot of people just don't want to know them. Oh,
well, that's
they put them in a box. Say, oh, don't talk to him. He's the raging alcoholic, and he's a bit, you know, off in the head. But that's not the case.
It probably is to a certain extent, but what happens is that the alcoholic and the addict, what we do, right, and I'll throw myself into this mix as well, is that we wear the loved ones out, and we get, and look, you know, it happens all over the place. I mean, you know, we get written off, and we deep down, we know that we're not useless, and we're not, you know, that we're worth something somewhere inside us. Sometimes
Does part of you push them away? Push?
Absolutely.
Push everybody away, maybe out of a sense of actual caring and consideration and love for them.
Sometimes, yeah.
100%. That's definitely what I did.
I am horrible. I see myself as a lone wolf. I see myself dying alone. I see myself spiraling alone. I love you. I'm sorry for what I've done to you. But go. go away and piss off, and I'm behaving badly in front of you to hasten that moment.
100%. That's what I did. I just couldn't stand the look in my family's eye anymore. And as a result, I hurt the ones that love me the most and you know, almost intentionally kept, you know, hurting them in worse
ways. Stop loving me.
That's right.
Start hating me. And then I won't have to. Then I won't have to face the heartbreaking notion of that I'm breaking your heart.
That's right. Just constantly running. Just constantly running.
And it's such a twisted disease, this, you know. Like the mind twists so much. You know, like it's horrible. It's almost unbelievable to describe what happens in the thinking of the addict. You know, like we get so twisted, and addiction is the disease of isolation. You know, like we want to push everyone away so that we can just be left alone to use and to drink, right? And some of us get nasty when other people come try and break into that, and some just get over emotional, or they get, you know, there's all these different things that can happen.
So is that when dealing with an addict?
Yep.
And administering tough love, and I want to read this SMS out. As a copper, we see the desperation of families wanting to help by covering the addict's ass. Couldn't agree more that tough love is the option. Otherwise, the addict will keep wanting and demanding more of their families. I mean, that's stripping it back to a pretty real day-to-day manifestation of what goes on.
It's spot on.
So is it important because the addict in part wants to push away those who love them? If that is the case...
They do, but don't.
I'm saying, that's why. Is it important when applying, call it tough love if you will, but certainly stop becoming an enabler and becoming part of the solution, not the problem, by not offering the safety net of money, a roof, food and excuses? When you take that away, is it still important to make it very clear that you love the person?
It sure is, Finey. It's exactly right, you know. And so really, what it is putting in boundaries, really. And what it's saying to the person is that, well, this is what I need to survive in my life. I don't need you here destructing my life. So I'm going to put these boundaries up. If you cross them, you're going to get thrown out. But if you want to come inside this boundary, I want you here. I really want you here, right? But the only way that I can do that, coming back to the I statements, the only way that I can do that is if you want to get some help. And if you want to get some help, the door's open, you're in. If you don't want to get help, that's your choice, but you ain't coming in here. That's really what needs to happen.
Is it practical on a day-to-day? It's great to say it. Is it practical, and can people do it? Jack, you say that the greatest obstacle to the addict getting into recovery is the family. What are some of the problems that family provides? Give us some actual manifestations of you as a counsellor thinking, oh, jeepers, one step forward with this bloke, family takes me one step back. What are they doing?
So the most common one is what we were talking about before, when I'm doing some work with a particular family member or maybe even a couple of family members, but I yet haven't spoken to the partner, or I've spoken to the partner and they're still under the manipulation of the addict, and we get to the point where everybody's going to sit down and really put a strong intervention in place, and then I get a call later that day and the partner has gone and listen to the lies again of the addict when everyone else is on board with the intervention process, and bang, it just unravels everything. And once that person puts one drug or drink into their system, or gambles or whatever it might be, they're off and running and on a destructive path, and we're so close to having them in the door.
And it might be months. They might not ever get it.
That's right.
They might miss their opportunity.
That's right.
So what has the partner done to derail the process in an actual sense?
Well, it might be convincing the partner that, no, I just need to do these couple more days of work to pay for little Johnny's school shoes so that he can go and do this, right? They give into it, bang, they're gone. guess what? Little Johnny doesn't even get any school shoes anyway, and the addict is off.
He's off and racing.
He's off and running.
So it's all about buying time. It's all about. So what will quite often happen with addiction is that the addict will put a barrier in place to be able to move forward straight away. So we know that when an addict like really, 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 really is ready, right, where they really want help, they're in that, you know, they're few and far between, but when they really want help, we know they need to act now. So we know that if a person is going to come in and really start treatment, if they don't come in or agree to come in within the first 24 hours of contacting us, right, or certainly the first 48 hours, there's a very, very low likelihood that they will actually start the program because they've got too much time with the family. The family can be emotionally manipulated because they're emotionally involved. We don't get emotionally manipulated because we're not emotionally involved, right? But the family members are. So that can be anything from, you know, just like what Jack said, to, you know, convincing a loved one or convincing a family member that I'm sorry and I really can control this and it really wasn't, you know, like it was a mistake what happened. You know, like us addicts are great at, you know, getting other family members to believe our own bullcrap, you know.
Off the SMS, I'm going to read out a very, it's almost poetic, it's almost a piece of prose. It's, I think this is the sort of thing you can go away and study, but you'll have 3 minutes to study it, boys, because when we come back, talk me through this, talk the listener through this. I'm an addict. Nothing better than being wasted and winning big coin on the punt. Hashtag living. When we come back, tell me about the person that sent that in. There's no
time like the right time. Welcome back.
So tell me about this SMS-er. I'm an addict. Nothing better than being wasted and winning coin on the punt. Hashtag living.
Go for it, Jack. Tell us what you were talking about before.
Well, it just screams to me, first of all, denial. And I remember one thing that happened to me, and we're discussing this a little bit in the break, was that, you know, at the start of my addiction, I thought it was great. I thought it was fantastic. I loved it because I hadn't experienced any of the real consequences. But as soon as the real consequences came, I hated it and I just wanted to be out of it. But I wouldn't tell anyone. I would put this front up to my family that this was my life and this is what I was going to do. And, you know, almost put my middle finger up to the sky and said, you know, I don't want any more of this world. But really, it was all fake.
So if you are listening now and you're an addict who can honestly say to yourself that your addiction has not negatively impacted on anybody, particularly people you care about, that your addiction has not denied you a lifestyle that you want to have, and that your addiction hasn't impacted on you physically to a point of concern, then maybe keep going for it, because I don't think any addicts can say that.
No, that's right.
If you're the, you know, if you're the lone, if
keep going, if anything changes,
yeah,
we'll look at it then.
Yeah, but if you can honestly say that your addiction has negatively impacted on nobody, especially people you care about, and that you are not denying yourself through your addiction anything that you want to do, or you haven't missed any opportunities, and it's the place you want to be right now is devoted to and slavishly addicted to and in need of the drink, the drug, the punt, and you can do all that and honestly say life's great, then
more power to you. Go for it.
Addiction's a newer of perfect fit, but I don't think you're an addict, and I don't think that's true. Well, you might be an addict, but I don't think that's true.
I don't think so either, but, you know, look, I went through a period in my addiction, and it was like I was a blatant addict. So from the moment a drink touched my lips,
yep,
right, it was pretty obvious that I was stuffed, right? Okay, but I kept going, right? I kept going for a long while. But there was a point in the middle where I used to go, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Who gives a crap? Crack a stubby, bang it down my throat, big smile on the face, and go, so what? I'm an addict. I'm an alcoholic, and I can't stop. So
yeah,
this is what I do.
But even if you could tick off on all of that, this is what I do, you couldn't honestly say that it wasn't negatively impacting on people.
No, but I can tell you that I was in enough denial that I truly thought that it was nobody else's business what I was doing, and I wasn't hurting anyone.
Did you think life was great?
At certain moments when I was drinking, I did.
So if life was so great, it didn't dawn on you that what you were doing was potentially cutting your life short by up to 50%? That didn't bother you? If life's so great, why were you bringing it to a rapid end?
Well, you know what? That's just part of the disease of denial and the confusion and the madness that happens in addiction, you know? Like most people that are in full-scale addiction are in complete and utter denial and are under... It took me probably 5 years into recovery, right, to really recall and understand the impact I'd had on people in my using and drinking. You know, when I tried to kill myself by jumping off the Blackburn Road Bridge over the Monash Freeway, my sister received a call at work. Now, I only know this because she told me. I wasn't aware of this until years into my recovery. Years. She told me of the call that she got the next morning, right, from the hospital, saying that your brother's in here, he's tried to kill himself last night, he's jumped off the Monash Bridge over the Monash Freeway. And, like, she, like, passed out. She fainted at work, right? Like, she was absolutely shattered, and in so much fear, and actually went to the hospital and begged the doctors to commit me, right? But I had absolutely no concept of that, none whatsoever, not even in my recovery, not even for the first 4 or 5 years of recovery. I thought, what's her problem? She doesn't even speak to me. What's her problem? You know, like, I was just so arrogant, just so self-absorbed, right? So much in denial still. And it takes time for the fog to lift. So if you can imagine, you know, the big, you know, tree that's been there for 100 years in the forest, and it gets cut down, and it lands in the water, and it sits in the water for 20 years, or however long you bloody use or drink, that you get the big cranes and you pull it out of the big river, you sit it on the bank, is it completely dried out the next day? No. It takes a long time for that thing. It's waterlogged. It takes a long, long time, years, for that thing to dry out. And it's the same with alcoholism and addiction. We've soaked ourselves, not just in the substance of using and drinking, but the psychology of using and drinking, the emotional turmoil, the stuff that we've done that we've had to, we have had to block so much stuff out because no human, right, that has any sense about them could live with the crap that we do.
Unless you're a psychopath or a sociopath.
That's right.
You can't
live with it.
You can't live with the pain that you're inflicting.
That's right. So you've got to block it out. And it is, believe me, it's blocked out. It's not just pretending to be blocked out. It's blocked out.
People are very good at compartmentalizing.
Yep.
They can put to one side the deepest, most horrific truths and go about their daily business because the mind operates like that. But I guess what you're saying is that for the addict to truly be recovered, or at least for the recovery to truly have a chance to be permanent,
yep,
the compartments all have to be opened, they have to be looked at,
yep,
and dealt with.
Correct. And it takes time. Mm. And a lot of help. Nobody really, truly does this completely on their own.
Nobody.
If you've been an addict for 3 days, you could probably knock it on the head in 3 days.
But maybe.
But then, is there such a, you know, a three-day addict?
Not many will want to stop.
Yeah. The three-day addict is maybe as rare as the addict who can honestly say they've impacted negatively on nobody and
yeah, that's right.
It's been a great life choice.
Yes.
They maybe go hand in hand. They're not you and they're not somebody you care about. They're not who we talk about this program. I want to thank Jack Nagel and Mick Hall from Dayhab, 1-800-329-422.
Good on you, Finey.
There are answers. There are solutions. But none of them come without really honest introspection. I think we covered off on that tonight.